So we're on this morning. The first argument we have scheduled is in case number 79569, Performance Steel Inc. versus Wollner Tooling. We also have consolidated with that appeal number 79993. We are scheduled today for a half hour argument, 15 minutes per side. Is everybody ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, perfect. In that case, Mr. Smith, did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, about 3 minutes. I'll keep my eye on the clock.
Right. So as you know, because you're experienced here, when it gets down to 3 minutes, the yellow light will go on, but the time will keep going. So it's up to you to stop and reserve the time. As to respondent, when you get down to 5 minutes, the yellow light will come on with the tone just to remind you you're down to 5 minutes, but obviously you keep going for your full time as needed. With that, Mr. Smith, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court, William Smith on behalf of Performance Steel. Following remand from the Court of Appeals, the District Court committed clear legal error by denying Performance Steel's request under Rule 15b to amend its pleadings to conform to the evidence and the election of remedies at trial. Despite voicing significant disagreement with the Court of Appeals' analysis of the election, the District Court nonetheless denied Performance Steel's request because the District Court concluded that the appellate mandate foreclosed it. That was incorrect for two reasons. First, Rule 15b allows an amendment at any time, even after judgment and even following remand, particularly in cases like this where the appellate mandate does not specifically foreclose an amendment back at the lower court. Second, neither law of the case nor the mandate rule is the amendment that Performance Steel sought here to avoid a clearly erroneous decision and to prevent manifest injustice. The District Court's denial of Performance Steel's request has led to the inequitable and frankly odd result where the undisputed breaching party has not only avoided the consequences of its breach, obtained a windfall from receiving the discounted steel price, but also been awarded a windfall amount of attorney's fees and costs of almost $1 million based upon the contract that it breached, and even if the Court of Appeals was correct, was no longer in the case. First, I'll address Rule 15b, and then I'll address law of the case, mandate rule issues, and then finally the attorney's fees issue.
Mr. Smith, before you do that, this is Justice Herndon, if I could. I'm curious about the propriety of your appeal, other than potentially maybe on the attorney's fees issue, based upon the fact that it appears that yourself, as well as Wollner, as well as the court, all treated the amended judgment from April of 2019 as a final judgment, and then proceeded forth with memo of costs, motion to retax, motions for attorney's fees, etc., with you not even filing an amended judgment motion until 4 months thereafter, which is far beyond 59E's 28-day time period, as well as not having filed an appeal.
Yes, Your Honor. The first amended judgment entered in April of 2019 did not resolve all claims against all parties. Under NRAP 3A, only final judgments are appealable. And a final judgment, as this court has defined in the Lee versus GNLB case and others, a final judgment is a judgment that resolves all claims against all parties. But the initial amended judgment following remand in April of 2019 merely vacated the award in favor of Performance Steel under count one. It didn't dismiss that claim. Compare, for example, the orders or the judgment's treatment of Wollner's counterclaims versus its treatment of count one. Count one was simply vacated and left just kind of hanging out there. It wasn't formally dismissed. It was simply just vacated. And this court's decisions have said, again, in Lee versus GNLB and others, it's not how the party is treated. It's what is the effect of the order. And the order here did not resolve all claims against all parties. That didn't occur until much later when Performance Steel filed its motion to amend the judgment to ensure finality. Until then, had we had Performance Steel filed an appeal, I'm confident this court would have issued an order to show cause, wondering what's the status of count one. Count one was sort of left hanging out there, vacated, but not formally dismissed. And the amended judgment is separately appealable under this court's decision in Morrell, M-O-R-R-E-L-L, and under NRAP 4A subsection 5, because the amended judgment disturbed and revised settled legal rights by formally dismissing count one. And then under NRAP 4A subsection 5, where it substantively altered rights. Again, dismissing count one. Until count one was dismissed, there was no final judgment resolving all claims against all parties. And I understand Your Honor's concern about NRAP 59E well beyond that deadline. But let's remember, that deadline is only 28 days, and the deadline to appeal is 30 days. It simply can't be the case that a non-final judgment somehow becomes final once the 28-day time period has run. So the final judgment in October of 2019, after Performance Steel filed its motion to amend to ensure finality, and Performance Steel's notice of appeal was filed within 30 days of that second amended judgment. So this court does have jurisdiction over this appeal to review whether the district court erred by denying Performance Steel's request under Rule 15B. Under Rule 15B, a party may move at any time, including after remand. Amendments should be granted liberally and to avoid injustice, and those same factors apply even to cases that have gone up on appeal once and been remanded. We cite a number of decisions, particularly the Tenth Circuit decision in REB versus Ralston Farina, which addresses the factors courts should consider when assessing amendments following remand. It generally followed the same Rule 15 factors, with of course, the addition of considering whether the appellate court's mandate specifically foreclosed it. So courts look at, for example, delay, prejudice, and whether the appellate court's mandate says no further amendments. Those aren't obstacles here. In fact, there was good cause to consider Performance Steel's request to amend count one to conform to the evidence at trial that Walner breached the underlying requirements contract.
Mr. Smith, this is Justice Kadish in Carson City. So the Court of Appeals, I guess it didn't reverse. It says it reversed also, but it vacated the award of damages, although it did also order the judgment of the district court reversed and remanded for proceedings consistent. But it vacated also, it said, it vacated the award of damages because it held that your clients had abandoned their claim for breach of contract damages that would have allowed it to get the difference between the discounted price and the original price. I mean, that was the reasoning, is that they said, look, you dismissed that claim, you can't recover damages on it at trial. And having made that decision, how does that make sense to then go back and now allow you to do it and start over? Like, it seems inefficient, if not unlawful. Explain that, please.
Certainly. Two points, Your Honor. Really what the Court of Appeals said was this. The Court of Appeals said that the election as structured at trial did not encompass breach of the original requirements contract as part of count one. And I think that's clearly contradicted by the actual record. At 2671 and 2672 of the record, the scope of the election was clearly laid out on the record. And I understand that the Performance Steel elected to proceed on counts one and four, but we have to look at the record to see how count one was there structured as part of the election. And I normally wouldn't take the court's time to do this, and I block quoted in my briefs, but here's the scope of the election at 2671 and 2672 of the record. Here's what the district court said. Quote, my understanding of what they've just told me is that they are proceeding on the theory that there is a contract that expired on May 31st, 2011, which they believe is an extension, which is a factual finding. And if I make a determination that there was not an extension, that they then would like the contract price under the contract through the term of the contract and have unjust enrichment damages after the expiration of the contract. Is that what you said? Mr. Quinlan for Performance Steel said yes. So that was the scope of the election. If the court finds there's no meeting of the minds on count one, then the court was going to look at the original requirements contract, which was originally covered by count two, admittedly. Well,
I know, Mr. Smith, wasn't the first appeal the place to argue that, though? Like, I get your argument, and I'm frankly sympathetic to your argument, but the Court of Appeals ruled, and that's the law of the case.
Well, no, Your Honor, for two reasons again. Number one, Performance Steel couldn't have made this argument on appeal because it was the prevailing party. Judge Gonzalez had entered a judgment in conformity with the election that Performance Steel actually obtained,
well,
so it wasn't an agreement.
Hold on. So when WTE appealed and was before the Court of Appeals and said, court, you need to reverse this damages award because they abandoned this claim for damages, did you not respond and say, no, that's not what we did, this is what everyone understood?
No, we did dispute those points, Your Honor. That is correct. We did dispute those points. And all the Court of Appeals was saying was that the election at trial did under count one did no longer encompass count two. The Court of Appeals said nothing about whether an amendment was available and remanded for further proceedings. And your point about the law of the case doctrine, this court has recognized in Shu versus County of Clark, that's SHU, cited on page 31 of Wallner's reply brief. Shu versus County of Clark, the court has recognized that the law of the case doctrine is subject to equitable exceptions. Three of them generally, the one that applies here, is to avoid clearly erroneous decisions and to avoid manifest injustice. Based upon the transcript and the scope of the election I just read, it simply can't be squared with the Court of Appeals determination. My friends on the other side, Wallner, have never offered an explanation about how what the district court said at 2671 and 2672, how that can be squared with the appellate court mandate, because it can't.
But Mr. Smith, I do have a question. I'm sympathetic to your position, but you quoted the same portions of the trial transcript in your answering brief in the first appeal, and the Court of Appeals rejected that and said, no, under count one, you can't have damages. I would have thought that would be binding on the remand, and I'm concerned that's what Judge Gonzalez also thought, and I understand the equitable exception that you're calling on, but would you agree that read literally, the Court of Appeals opinion would preclude the argument that it was all a mistake and you really meant to reserve?
No, Your Honor, I don't. Because all the Court of Appeals determined was the scope of the election at that time did not encompass claims under the original requirements contract. It said nothing about foreclosing the amendment after the fact. And so we're here reviewing the Rule 15 request. So, and the Court of Appeals didn't foreclose an amendment, and also to your point, Justice Pickering, the law of the case doctrine is subject to equitable exceptions. It is true that in the vast majority of cases, law of the case doctrine will be binding. But this court said in Shue versus County of Clark that that rule is not jurisdictional and subject to equitable exceptions, including to avoid clearly erroneous decisions and manifest unjust results. And I understand that that should be used sparingly and in rare cases, but if there is a case where it applies, this is it, given what the record is and given the nature of the Court of Appeals ruling. So I understand in the vast majority of cases what an appellate court says governs, but there are equitable exceptions, including to avoid clearly erroneous decisions and manifest injustice.
Did you make any argument to the district court that under count four, you should have recovered the $167,000 that was awarded under count one by the district court originally, because the discounts were extended in the mistaken belief that you were you had a valid extension contract that proved to be wrong? Wouldn't that be more of an equitable remedy than a contract one? And then that brings me to my second point. Was it a strategic call that led you to insist on the contract amendment as opposed to the damages because you're trying to get the attorney's fees to swing?
To your first point, Your Honor, that's actually how the argument originally briefed. If you look at the party's respective election briefs, that's how it was originally argued, where the difference in contract price was actually going to be considered under count four for unjust enrichment. But the way that it got structured actually at trial was that unjust enrichment then became attached to the claims after the end of the original requirements contract. But you're right. I mean, initially, how it was structured and argued at first, the judgment could have been upheld under the unjust enrichment claim for difference. That's how it was originally argued.
But did you argue that on remand from the Court of Appeals? Because that wouldn't probably be precluded by the Court of Appeals mandate.
No, we didn't, Your Honor, because we didn't even get that far. Judge Gonzalez at 3297 of the record basically just said, I read the mandate as not even allowing me to consider this, end of story. That would be an argument if there is a remand here. That would be an argument available. But at the time, Judge Gonzalez didn't even think any further arguments were available, which is incorrect under 15B and the exceptions to law of the case. And unless if there's any further questions, I'll reserve the balance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Lenhard.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Kirk Lenhard and Nikki Baker, who is also with me this morning, on behalf of the Wallner parties. May it please the court. It's always difficult when you're the respondent because you have your notes prepared for your argument, and based on the comments or questions of the court, you end up tearing up your argument. That's what I'm doing this morning. Starting first with the questions raised by Justice Herndon on the jurisdictional issue, I don't think I need to remind the court that the amended judgment, the first amended judgment, was noticed on April 10, 2019. If the plaintiffs, the PSI parties, felt that order was somehow inadequate, they had 28 days under NRCP 59E to amend that judgment. They chose not to.
Well, Mr. Lenhardt, this Justice Kadish, doesn't Rule 59 only apply to amending a judgment? And if it wasn't, in fact, a judgment, then does that apply?
I think it does. What else can they do except appeal, file the notice of appeal within 30 days, which they chose not to? But let's go back to the language itself of the two amended document, the amended document and the second amended document. Where is there any question about the finality in the amended judgment? And I will, at risk of boring the court, here is the language of the amended judgment. Pursuant to the directives set forth in the order of reversal and remand entered on August 28, 2018, for Nevada Court of Appeals, the court vacates the order to breach of contract damages and prejudgment interest on said damages. The court incorporated by reference the Court of Appeals decision. There is no question about the finality and the termination based on this amended judgment. Does the added language dismissal in any way at all alter the finality of the amended judgment? No. Does it reset the appellate clock? It certainly should not. Did it uncertainty. It certainly did not. It should not involve any rights lost by an untimely appeal. Jurisdictionally, and I say this very carefully, the court should not consider this appeal. They had under 59E or NRA, they had ample opportunities to protect their record, to protect their appeal. They chose not to. Decisions, consequence.
Well, what do you make of the fact that the Court of Appeals used the language vacate and also reverse and remand? It could have, if it had straight up reversed on the contract damages and remanded to enter final judgment. It seems to me that the vacater contemplates further action by the district court.
And further action is what? To award damages to Walner and clarify what the district court had done is what she did. She, instead of awarding damages to PSI, she amended the damage award from a couple $100,000 down to approximately $51,000. That's what's meant by the vacation here. She amended her order to comply with the order of the Court of Appeals.
The word dismissed,
required was clearly the Court of Appeals had reversed her decision that to somehow award damages under count two, a count that was dismissed with prejudice under California law. A question was coming?
Yeah, Mr. Lenhardt, this is Justice Herndon. Thank you. I apologize. I was interrupting you. My understanding is, and I don't recall who the movement was, but my understanding was the amended judgment came about as a result of somebody moving the court to amend the judgment in conformance with the COA decision. Is that correct?
There was a motion to amend the judgment following the initial order of the court.
Yes.
Are you referring to that?
I apologize. I wasn't very specific there. But the original first amended judgment occurred as a result of somebody moving the court to amend the judgment to be in conformance with the Court of Appeals' original decision, correct?
All right. I misunderstood your question. I believe we filed the initial motion to amend.
Okay.
We filed the amended judgment. That was our initial.
Okay.
We noticed it on April 10th.
It's also my belief, as is generally the practice of the trial court judges, that both parties were invited to submit proposed amended judgments at that time, and performance chose not to submit a proposed judgment and not object to the proposed judgment that was ultimately signed?
You have it right on both counts.
All right. Thank you.
Not only did they not object, Once that, as I've already pointed out, once that order was submitted and the new judgment was submitted, they did not appeal timely, nor did they move to amend it. There's been a reference to the Sue decision and the law of the case doctrine. I'm old enough that I've had a number of cases before this court. I tried the Sue case in front of Judge Mark Gibbons when he was still on the district court bench, and I did both Sue appeals. It is true in the Sue case that there was a change in the law doctrine because there was a change in the law. The Sue decision was changed by the Sisolak decision. That is not the case here. Both Judge Gonzalez and the Court of Appeals both determined that the election made at the time of trial, Judge Gonzalez said it was a stipulation, the Court of Appeals said it was voluntary, but that issue was key to both decisions. And under the law of the case doctrine, if that is a key to the decision, it's binding on, in one appeal, it's binding on the future appeal, and therefore binding on this court. There has not been a change in the law or an equitable change to justify this court walking away from the case law of the case doctrine. The law of the case in this case is very clear. The election made by trial counsel to dismiss count two was voluntary. And if there's any doubt about the validity of that election, simply look at the record. Where do you see an objection to the election?
Well, Mr. Lenhardt, this is Justice Kader. So,
yeah, thank you.
So let's talk about this. So the quote that Mr. Smith read from when the election was made on the record and the court summarizing what she understood the election to be clarified that, in fact, that's what Performance Steel intended. And then the Wallner parties did not object. So, you know, apparently everyone understood that if the extended contract theory was not accepted, then they could still get the contract damages for the period until the original contract expired. Is that not the case?
Under an unjust enrichment claim. And as the court argued with the counsel for plaintiff, I'm not bound to award contract damages on an unjust enrichment claim. It's an equitable claim, and contract damages are a legal claim. She made that clear. The election was made by Mr. Quinlan, and he had a right to make that election. I'm not objecting to that election, nor could I object to that election. But it's up to the court to determine the extent of damages under an unjust enrichment claim. That was always my understanding. Of course I'm not going to object.
Did you object to them seeking contract damages based on the rejection of the extension theory?
No. No, wait. I mean, I would have objected if they stood up and said we're somehow merging counts one and count two or consolidating counts one and count two.
Well,
words were never uttered.
So wait. I apologize, and it's hard to go back and forth in this context. So later on in the trial, it's my understanding that Performance Steel sought to amend the pleading, I guess, to conform to the evidence or to make sure and reference the ability to get the contract damages for the period before the contract expired. And the court said, and apparently counsel for Wallner agreed, that amendment wasn't necessary to be able to ask for that.
That's not what they asked, Judge. Your Honor, excuse me, that is not what was requested in the amendment at the end of the trial.
Okay, go ahead and explain.
They requested two things. They requested an amendment to allege the covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
Right, we can bypass that.
The second amendment was the Steelscape argument. Wallner had bought steel from Steelscape, and PS5 wanted damages for that issue, and the judge said it was not necessary. They did not attempt to amend at the end of trial to somehow consolidate counts one and count two so they could still recover contract damages and the difference between the discount price and the contract price of the contract under count two. That was never sought in an amendment at the end of trial. Look at the record. And if they would have sought that, if they would have sought a consolidation, I can guarantee you I would have objected. It didn't happen.
Well, does it not make sense that if in fact there wasn't a meeting of the minds on an agreement for an extension of the contract, that they should be able to recover the difference between the discounted price and the contract price?
Why didn't they make that election, Your Honor? They had a chance to make that election if they chose. They chose not to. I can only surmise why they didn't, because they didn't stand up and object and explain their objection. And they're asking this court now to surmise what the objection would have been, which is unfair to the trial court, unfair to counsel, and unfair to this court, because the objection's not clarified. But I can only surmise at this point that they didn't want the court compromising. They were going for the big bucks. They were going for count one. And they didn't want the court compromising and coming back at count two. And they kept unjust enrichment as an insurance policy. And that's surmising on my part because, again, the objection's not clear on the record. The only objection we have on the circuit, if you want to call it that, is a bench brief where they don't object. They cite the J.A. Jones case, but they put it into context. The court is left to assume what their objection is, and that is not consistent with the contemporaneous objection rule, and the duty of counsel to stand up and make their objection clear so the court can correct it if it's making an error, and the appellate court can understand exactly what the objection is. That was not done here, and that's creating part of the problem that you and I are discussing right now.
Now, can you address the attorney's fees issue, given that the court found that there was no extension of the contract, and if the claim was abandoned as to the prior contract, what's the basis for getting attorney's fees?
There's a misunderstanding in the appellant's brief. We never sought attorney's fees on count two. That was dismissed with prejudice. We sought and obtained attorney's fees based on the fee order on count one, which was the extension of the requirements contract. And if you go back and look at the trial record, 80% of that trial was dedicated to that issue. They chose to go forward on count one, the requirements contract and the extension. We prevailed on count one. They've admitted that's a contract claim, both in their complaint, answers to interrogatories, and in their pretrial memo. There's no question that's a contract claim. It's also governed by California law, which is California Civil Section 1717, I believe. And under that section, the prevailing party, even if the prevailing party establishes a contract didn't exist, or a contract was somehow not breached or whatever, the prevailing party gets their fees. And there's a corollary under the California law, and that is if PSI would have been entitled to fees if they would have prevailed on the requirements contract count one, then Walter's entitled to its fees if they prevailed on count one. We prevailed on count one, even though we prevailed on the basis there was no contract. Under California law, we're still the prevailing party. We're entitled to our fees. More importantly, though, on the issue, they keep saying it's unfair that we're receiving our fees. We're the breaching party. If we're a breaching party at all, it's on a count that was dismissed with prejudice. They made that decision. When they made that decision to go with count one, that became the controlling contract for fees and the ultimate issue before the court. We ultimately prevailed on that issue, both before Judge Gonzalez, before the Court of Appeals, and I would suggest under those circumstances, the fee award is appropriate. I see I'm down to 10 seconds, so I will, unless you have additional questions, I'll give away my last few seconds.
Thanks very much, Mr. Lenhard. Mr.
Smith. Thank you.
Go ahead on rebuttal.
I want to start with Justice Herndon's question about the proposed order. To answer your question, Justice Herndon, Performance Steel was not asked to submit a proposed order. Waldner did move to amend and submit a proposed order. And what Performance Steel did in response to object was to then file its request for Rule 15b to amend. So in response to the request for an amended order, Performance Steel then moved to amend under 15b. And so the objection to the proposed order can be seen as part of Performance Steel's request to amend at 3177 of the record.
I apologize. I know you don't have a lot of time, and I'll give you more time if you need it to answer questions. But I'm having a hard time hearing you, and I just want to understand. So the procedure, I understand you moved to amend it, or you filed some sort of motion and ultimately got the second amended judgment. What was the process before the amended judgment was entered on remand?
Sure, it is a little bit confusing, so I understand the court's question there. The following remand, Walner filed a motion for leave to amend to enter an amended judgment on OST, order shortening time. Performance Steel filed an opposition to that, but also asked for a time for additional briefing. Then Performance Steel filed another brief, I think maybe entitled a request to amend, but in that pleading at 3177 of the record, that's where Performance Steel made its Rule 15b request. And then Walner then filed a reply, which functioned both as a reply in support of its motion to amend and in opposition to Performance Steel's Rule 15b request. So that's sort of the procedure on how the request to amend and how the initial first amended judgment was entered.
So the 15b motion preceded entry of the first amended judgment on remand, is that right?
That's correct. And in fact, if you look at that order, it specifically contemplates that the Rule 15b request to be treated separately. So that's correct. That request was made before the first amended judgment.
All right. I'll give you 30 seconds to wrap up.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to your point, on the election, that is how everybody understood it, at 2671 of the record. Mr. Lenhart himself eventually said, I don't have a question on it, so he didn't have that structure. Everyone argued it, and Mr. Lenhart, in closing arguments, argued the original requirements contract. That's at 2804 and 2805. Judge Gonzalez asked both sides three questions, one of which was geared toward calculating the damages if she found no meeting of the minds. So the court asked both parties, how would I calculate damages between the contract price and the concession price? And in closing arguments, Mr. Lenhart, without objection at 2804 and 2805, and also 2800 and 2801, responded to that question, helping the district court say, here's what the damages would be if you don't find a meeting of the minds. So everybody participated on that. Mr. Lenhart didn't object. Everyone understood.
Okay.
And with regard
Justice
to
Kadish, I have a question. May I have a moment to question Mr. Smith? I'm sorry.
Sure, go ahead.
I want to hear on the attorney's fees issue, because your opponent makes the point that you're arguing that, well, they didn't recover under the contract, the original contract. But the point of the matter is their argument is you asserted an extended contract, and they won on that claim. And they seem to be saying, and California law seems to say, that when that happens, the contract asserted, even if it's determined to be non-existent, is looked to determine the right to attorney's fees. And that contract had a generous attorney's fee clause in it. So to the extent you voluntarily dismissed the count one or count two, that doesn't matter. But they won on the remaining contract claim. And I'd like to hear your comments on that, on whether or not California law incorporates the attorney fee clause in the asserted contract, even when the asserted contract is found to be non-existent.
Certainly, are. As the general proposition you described is accurate, but the only contract here, the only document with an attorney's fees provision, was Section 17 of the underlying requirements contract. The same contract that, if the Court of Appeals was correct, was dismissed, is no longer in the case. And under 1717b2, then it's a voluntary dismissal. There's no prevailing party. It simply can't be the case that the requirements contract was in the case enough to award $1 million in attorney's fees to Walner, but the requirements contract wasn't in the case to affirm the original judgment to Performance Steel. Both of those things simultaneously cannot be true. On the extended contract, there wasn't a meeting of the minds, according to the district court, on the extension. So they can't possibly say there was no meeting of the minds on the term of the contract, so the contract's unenforceable, but somehow there was a meeting of the minds on the attorney's fees in the extended contract. Only attorney's fee provision here is in the original requirements contract, which the Court of Appeals said was dismissed. Additionally,
thank
under
you.
California law, thank you, Your Honor.
All right. All right. I appreciate it. We gave you some additional time because of our questioning. So thanks, counsel, very much for your briefing and argument today. We'll be in recess until our next argument at 11.